So when I talk about this dimension of zero, it's an awakening to the part of ourselves that doesn't need any more time to be fine, because nothing ever happened there. Nothing's happening there. Nothing will ever happen there. When Lao Tzu meditated, when the Buddha meditated, and when you meditate, and 200,000 years from now when some meditates, they're going to wake up to that same dimension. Nothing is nothing, it's absolute. When Lao Tzu says, the Tao that can be named is not the eternal Tao, the character for eternal is Chang. In Chinese, it's Chang, constant, eternal, unchanging. And what the perennial traditions related to as ultimate truth was that which is unchanging. And the only unchanging they knew was zero. Because everything out here in the world was changing. To have a body, this is the body, and to have a body is to suffer, and to go through this endless cycle of birth, death, incarnating into suffering, until you evolve to a place where you get free of the wheel, and then you don't have to come back because it sucks being here. Don't you know? And if you've ever been to Delhi, you can understand why they would have drawn that conclusion, let alone Calcutta. Let alone Calcutta, you can understand why they would, the goal of spiritual endeavor would have been escape. But as a postmodern individual who was raised in the most fortunate demographic of all human beings to have ever lived, I can't relate to life as primarily being suffering, which doesn't mean I don't suffer, but the suffering is just something I need to bear with dignity for the sake of this greater realization, and that realization is rooted in the dimension of zero, which is there is no problem, there never was a problem, there isn't any problem. And you can tell how sincerely a person who professes to be interested in any of the Eastern traditions has actually done their practice and actually authentically awoken to zero by the degree of ease that person manifests under stress. Everything else is just talk. So the question is, to what degree when a person is under stress do they express pre-thought and transmit pre-thought a deep-rootedness in there's no problem. Everything's perfect just as it is. In that realization of emptiness, the subject, see, I'm out here in this wheel, Lonnie, born in time, who's going to die in time, and at the moment of death, all those memories scatter to the wind. So I'm out here in the wheel, and in one moment, everything in that wheel is revealed to be an object in my awareness, and I'm the awareness at the center of the wheel, and all of a sudden, what was the subject now becomes an object in awareness. And that objectivity is transmitted pre-thought at all times, in all places, through all circumstances, in a person who has found a moral imperative in it. But when the postmodern person... I heard that voice coming out of your stomach and I thought you were practicing ventriloquy. I said, well, that's impressive. Okay. So the point is that zero is ease and zero is objectivity. And why is the person awoken to zero? Why is there an ease in the face of stress? Because they're taking nothing personally. Because the personal itself has been revealed to be an illusion. The personal itself has been revealed to be an illusion. To the degree a person is intimidated by their own mind, they'll be intimidated by the minds of others. And to the degree a person is relating very personally to their own life experience, they're going to relate very personally and take everybody else's experience very personally themselves. And to the degree one is awoken to the realization that nothing is personal, nothing is personal, nothing is personal, the personal is a thin veil stretched over an infinite ocean of emptiness, if nothing is personal, then there's an increase of objectivity because one is not any longer taking things personally. Yes, sir.
Just the question would be, if everything is perfect, as I believe it is, why are we here? Why are we doing healing?
I'm going to tell you.
Pardon?
I'm going to tell you. He's asking me the meaning of life. And I wouldn't consider lecturing without revealing it. So we have talked about zero, and that zero is the absolute dimension of existence, and the only absolute dimension of existence that the perennial traditions were awoken to. At least the Eastern traditions. At least the Eastern traditions. Emptiness. So all of this is revealed in meditation, and in meditation there's no moral hierarchy because you don't have to do anything. And when Rumi says, beyond right doing and wrong doing, there's a field, I'll meet you there, he's pointing to an amoral dimension where everything is one. And there is no hierarchy. And there's only peace. And there's peace because you're taking the position of this dimension of God, which is no relationship to my experience. And then the infinite field reveals itself in the moment, and in the moment everything is perfect, because in the moment nothing is happening. And I can guarantee you can wake up to this and drive a motorcycle 110 miles an hour and perceive no movement. I can vouch for that because I've done it. I would have tried 120, but at 110 I was convinced the whole thing was going to disintegrate underneath me. But I said, this is interesting. I'm doing 65 driving home and nothing is moving. And the fastest it would get, but at 110 nothing moved either. Nothing's moving. Nothing's happening. It's all an illusion. So that's the realization of zero, and it's an amoral position. No morality is needed because nothing is happening. Consciousness has consciousness is a capacity, and it has two capacities. There's one consciousness, but because we're relative people living in a dualistic universe, we can recognize two aspects of consciousness, and the two capacities of consciousness are witnessing, which is the ever popular postmodern position in consciousness, witnessing. But the other capacity is choosing. Relative to zero, in meditation, the capacity of witnessing is liberated. So that we can witness, we can stand back from our own thoughts, feelings, and emotions, see them as an object in our consciousness that we have no relationship to. We can look at the self. I remember the moment I saw Lonnie Jarrett, I said, oh, I never was that. I could never be that. It was total shock in the moment. An ecstatic shock, but still a complete shock. So the subject became an object. Subject became an object. Okay. In meditation, zero. There's no morality. It's an amoral position. And there are lots of traditional Eastern philosophies based on the notion of waking up, realizing emptiness. You come in the world, there's nothing to do. Sit under your hut, never meet the people whose dogs are barking or roosters are crowing in the next town. There was no development back then. Can you imagine that Lao Tzu ever bought an abacus home and over dinner looked at his wife, Mrs. Tzu, and said, I can't believe it, I just bought this thing and they're coming out with a new model in 3 weeks? There was only a sense of cyclic change. There was no sense of vertical change. The Taoists saw vertical change as a fall from original nature. And you look at how they drew realized sages. And when Lao Tzu says, I am the wilderness before the dawn, and when the Nan Cheng tells you that in the good old days, people lived in harmony with the Tao, who are they referring to? 500 BC? Cavemen. People are just animals, no social structures, no ethics, no morality, no judgment. And that was the way you were to live in the world. It's all an illusion. So when the postmodern era came in after World War II, and we overthrew Hitler, who is a pretty judgmental cat, wouldn't you say? When we overthrew Hitler and through scientific rationalism throughout the Catholic Church, right? For much of Europe, right? Throughout the Church, throughout Hitler, throughout dominator hierarchies, we drew the conclusion that everything was equal. Where was I going with this? Tell me. This happens now and then. I come in here, I don't know what I'm going to say.
Meaning of life.
What?
The meaning of life.
No. Prior. What was I saying 10 seconds ago?
About the abacus. You were talking about
that. Right. Nowhere to go. Nothing to do. So you look at postmodernism, and it's just all about non-judgment. Hitler was judgmental. Hitler a dominator hierarchy. You have your truth. I have my truth. I won't judge you. You don't judge me. And compassion is conflated with non-judgment. So I will tell you the worst thing about me. People would pay to do exercises. I'm going to tell you something I've never told any other human, because basically it should be totally humiliating, because nobody should act like that. And now you're going to tell me something about you you've never told anyone, and then I won't judge you and you won't judge me. Nod, nod, wink, wink. Not holding each other to anything higher. No moral hierarchy whatsoever. In this context, spiritual transparency is just fessing up to the most base parts of ourselves, daring other people to judge us. And look at postmodern art. A lot of postmodern art, the only statement in it is, I dare you to not call this art. I'll put feces on a canvas, and the whole point is just to dare you to have a judgment. And then what's the drug of choice for postmodern people? Marijuana, which freezes liver yang and eliminates any sense of hierarchy, and you become happy to lay flat on your back staring at the ceiling. And maybe you can raise just enough liver yang to contemplate your own navel. Just editorially, pot stopped being a spiritual experience around 1968. I'm told it was very good for 2 weeks that summer. So that's the dimension of zero. It's amoral. It has nothing to do with, very little to do with living life beyond being rooted in a sense of no problem. Being rooted in a sense of emptiness. Being rooted in a dimension beyond the personality, beyond the self. Being rooted there. But something comes out of that rooting. We discovered in the 1800s something called evolution. We have enough historical perspective now to know the universe has been developing, at least in this corner of the universe. Scientists now believe the universe is possibly infinite, without beginning and without end. Which doesn't mean there wasn't a Big Bang, but the Big Bang around here seems to have happened about 14 to 15 billion years ago. And there's been a continuous trend toward increased states of complexity and integration for 15 billion years. And that's no illusion. That's no illusion. I know, because I've talked to my dog about this and he does not get it. And you just look at art. In our lifetime, there's been a lot of evolution. Right? When I was born, spousal rape was still legal. It was still legal in America for a man to rape a woman because he owned her if he was, right, married to her. Right? So when I was born, women were still property. It's just a fact. So there's been cultural evolution, right? There's cultural evolution. Culture is evolving all the time at lower levels of development, but our level of development, culture hasn't gone very far in the last 40 years because of this lack of hierarchy of values, the inability, the unwillingness to see spirit as higher. So we can look at this impulse that explodes out of emptiness, the evolution of, it's another face of God. Emptiness is one face of God. That's the infinite field, the infinite moment. But there's also a face of God which is ceaseless development. Why do you think God's point of view was when that meteor hit the earth after 14 billion years? So you leave hydrogen alone and you get Mozart. But it takes 14 billion years. And there's an impulse behind that. We're not just zero, we're the plus one. The movement in existence toward the next higher state, the next higher, 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 vertical development, higher, toward the true, the good, the beautiful, more complexity, more integration, a greater realization of oneness, a greater manifestation of consciousness. But those forms of consciousness are forms we're bringing in. They're not pre-existing. They're not out there waiting for form to manifest to be able to transmit them. They're simultaneously emergent and congruent with that form emerging. A sponge does not transmit consciousness. There's one consciousness in this universe, but it only awakens to itself commensurate with the degree of integration and complexity of the nervous system that's perceiving it. You have to be able to have a subject and not an object. You have to be able to perceive an it to then realize there is no it and that the it is you. There is a simplicity before complexity and a simplicity after complexity. Postmodern people love to imagine that the simplicity seen at earlier stages of development is equivalent to the simplicity after complexity. An infant and a sage both have spontaneity, but the infant is spontaneously selfish, and the sage is spontaneously selfless. And they are not the same expression. It is a mind-blowing moment in a parent's life when their child takes the first action that indicates they're aware there's something in the universe more important than just what they want in the moment. It's totally mind-blowing moment. So plus one is this impulse toward the true, the good, and the beautiful. Plus one is absolute. Forward, 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 better, better, faster, faster, higher, higher, more, when, now. No excuses, nothing in the way. And that dimension of God doesn't recognize your own fears and desires in relationship to having to leave the level of development that you or we are at for the sake of being vehicles for the next emergence. It's just the force that's pushing. What was God's relationship to having spent 15 billion years to get big lizards here? Do you think the meteor hit the earth and God said, "Oy, 14 billion years to make big lizards and it all went to hell. I think I'll go to Kripalu and get some R&R. I think I need a mud pack. Could you rub my feet? Honey, could you rub my shoulders? It's been a hard 14 billion years. I need a vacation." This was God's response. "We're going with the mammals." That's it. What's the next vehicle? Let's go. God, this face of God is just consciousness pushing its way into matter. And it doesn't care what the vehicle is. It doesn't care. It is true that if the human race wipes out, I have no doubt that consciousness will someday get further than where we are right now in the universe. I have no doubt. But that's a complete abdication of our responsibility, given what we're awakened to. But the postmodern person can feel no obligation or responsibility. To the postmodern person, we awaken to emptiness, we awaken to God, and we see acting out of that as an option that we're very casual in relationship to. Nataliana, you had a question?
I think I'll ask you later. I don't want to interrupt.
Fantastic. Eve?
So we're talking about the postmodern person and thoughts and awakening and the breath is very big, but then I think it's really important to their soul's journey, you know, like all these, you know, you're not talking on that level of the evolution of one's soul as they're coming in this context.
I'm not sure of the question.
Well,
so I could answer, but I'd be projecting. So can you formulate a question? I didn't hear a question. I heard you make some observations.
The question is, within the context of this evolutionary process that you are delineating, how do you hold soul as part of this process?
Well, I think the soul's... I was hoping to get to soul. We're not going to have time. But I mean, look, the soul is real. It's a dimension of experience. We are responsible for the evolution of our soul. We are responsible for it. That's what we're here for. And for the postmodern person, our ego thinks we got all the time in the world, baby. I'm doing another workshop next weekend. Got another retreat. Going to meditate some more. Take a little more Wu Wei Tzu. Banging my gongs. Postmodern ego puts all the time in the world. I would say, what about the realization that at our level of development, we're very, very casual about our responsibility for the soul? Look, if the operating culturally given construct is you have your truth, I have my truth, nobody has the truth, then most people's relationship to their own conscience, which is the voice of the soul... So the conscience is the part of us that informs us of the gap between the highest we've seen is true in our own experience and our actual state of development. So we're all very pretentious. We all think, you know, I've had these spiritual experiences and I read this great philosophy and I watch Watts the Bleep and I've seen the Celestine Chronicles, you know, 37 times, but I keep having negative thoughts, so I just keep watching it, hoping my negative thoughts will go away, because I must be doing something wrong. But we think we have all the time in the world. There's no urgency. No urgency. So if your point of view is, you have your truth, I have my truth, and your point of view, if one's point of view toward their own conscience is, thanks for sharing, that's an option. I could do this or I could do that, but I don't want to judge. That could be, my ego has its, but after all, I know I'm in this argument with you, and I want to say something that'll tear your heart to pieces. And my conscience says, I'm the metaphor, my conscience says, don't say it. But that's just its point of view, and my ego has its point of view. And who's to judge? So I can act on whichever impulse, and then you can't judge. And nobody can judge, and if you judge, it's because you're uptight. It's refusing to take responsibility for my own recognition of a hierarchy of impulses within me and wanting to say, I'm not going to act out of those anymore. I don't have the right to do X, Y, Z anymore. I don't have the right. So the postmodern relationship to its own soul is one of just another voice in my head. And therefore the soul is inert. Dying, suffering, looks sort of like Gollum in The Lord of the Rings, because we're all so self-involved. We're so this healing we're doing is self-involvement. We're the most lucky, fortunate people who've ever lived, and we're all concerned with healing. I'm 45, I'm 50, I'm 60. Look, if you've been a seeker for 10 years, that's very impressive. I'll call you in a sec. Save your chi. If you're a seeker for 10 years, it's very impressive. If you're a seeker for 20, nothing could be more impressive. But if you're a seeker for 30, something's up. And if you're a seeker for 40 years and you're not a finder, my conclusion is after 30, 40 years of seeking, that seeking's just a hobby. And that there's no real conviction about coming to the end of seeking and becoming a finder, which means you have been a seeker to the point that you've arrived at a state of no doubt. And now ready to commit wholeheartedly and without any reservation. And I will say in relationship to Nan Lu's talk that a real teacher shows you the whole thing in 5 seconds. In a very short amount of time, a real teacher transmits the whole apple orchard and the entire reality behind it. And the entire reality behind that really, really soon, I'm assuming, of course, you're sincere, and then just spends the rest of your life holding you to live up to its implications. That's what the highest teacher does. The highest teacher gives you the whole thing by grace now, and then the whole rest of your relationship is them helping you live what you've acknowledged you've seen, and nothing is held back. And it's that same truth that the teacher is surrendered to. The teacher is a living manifestation of what you have seen and expects you to be that, and confronts every part of you that was interested in the hobby of seeking but now regrets having found. Madam?
I was curious about the 7 levels past zero.
The what?
The 6 levels past zero.
Six levels.
You started talking about you were going to talk about these different aspects of being.
Oh, I didn't think I said 6 levels, but.
Maybe not levels.
Well, I am. Well, there's 0, then there's +1. I talked about different hierarchies of healing before, 1 through 12. I haven't otherwise. Anyway, we're talking +1. Well, there are only 3 absolute dimensions to experience. So we covered 0. I'm talking about +1, and then we're going to talk about -1. Okay? Good. So, +1 is this totally positive, mind-blowing impulse. It explodes out of 0, explodes out of emptiness. It is the evolutionary impulse. Most people only awaken to it at the level of sexuality. So sexuality is an expression of the evolutionary impulse. It's how the evolutionary impulse gets more vehicles here. And it makes sense that it would evolutionarily become highly pleasurable because consciousness needs a certain number of vehicles here, I'd say about 7 billion, for it to awaken to itself radically and become enlightened to itself in a way that wouldn't just be an emergence in the enlightened individual, but the entire culture would become the vehicle for the emergence of an enlightened consciousness that no single individual would ever be capable of holding. It would be an emergence far beyond that of any enlightened individual historically. And I'd say we're about at that level now, historically. Okay? So, +1. The movement toward the true, the good, the beautiful, the lowest level is sexuality. Does the sexual impulse itself have any ethics implicit within it? None, right? What does it want? It wants consummation now. You and me here right now, clear the table off. You never awaken to the sexual impulse and say to your partner, oh man, you know, do you think we could get together next Wednesday or maybe the Wednesday after that? I'm a little busy now. Like, there's no time in the picture. And there's no ethics. Does the sexual impulse care about you? Does it? Does it care about the object of your affection? Right? Gotta love the one you're with, right? Right? When the eagle flies with the dove, if you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with. The sexual impulse is amoral, right? It's only a movement forward. Consummate now, forward. Sir, you had a question?
Well, I think this, it does want to evolve.
There is a direction, an eros. Eros has a telos, a T-E-L-O-S. It has a direction forward, but it doesn't care about anything but that movement forward. The sexual impulse doesn't care if you get AIDS. It doesn't care if your partner get AIDS. It doesn't care about what commitments you've made to any other individual. It's just a movement right here, right now, right here, right now, right here, right now. And as a guy, I'll admit that I'm acutely aware of this. I think women are too, but at least as a guy, I'll admit it. It's just like we're genetically programmed. It's like right here, right now. It's like that's the impulse, right? There's no ethics in it. It's a direction. It's a momentum. It's a force. The next highest level people awaken to the evolutionary impulse at is at the creative level. The creative level, creativity. So when I was writing my books, Emily would come downstairs and she'd say, Lonnie, it's 4 a.m, you have to get up in 3 hours to see your next patient. I'd say, okay, I'll be right there. Imagine Edison. Mrs. Edison would come down. Thomas would have just tried his 1700th filament. It's 4 a.m, she'd say, Thomas, come to bed. He'd say, honey, in a moment. I'll be right there. When you're creating, whether it's dancing or creating art or music or whatever field of endeavor you're in and you're giving yourself to the creative impulse, there's this emergence. There's this emergence. Rabab knows. I looked at her 5 times today. I said, I have no idea what I'm going to talk about. I walk in and I sit down. I haven't looked at any notes. I walk in and I sit down and I look in the crowd and I start talking and there's something coming through and it's pre-thought, pre-cognition. And there's this passion. There's this passion, this creative passion. But we all know that and there's no time in the picture, just like with sex. There's no time in the picture. You know, Charlie Parker dropped out of school when he was 12 and played saxophone 18 hours a day for 10 years. Jimi Hendrix, John Coltrane, Wes Montgomery, these people dropped out of school 12 years old, 13 years old, and just had this passion, I have to play, I have to play, don't you understand, I have to play. Miles Davis said, I'm going to play it first and I'll tell you why later. It's a pre-thought emergence. But we all know you can be awoken to the creative impulse at the level of a Mozart, or at the level of a Jimi Hendrix, or at the level of a Miles Davis, and be completely debauched. And the ethical line of your development is nowhere near the creative line of your development, or the intellectual or cognitive line of your development. Integral development means no part of the person left behind. And that means we have to, as postmodern people, recognize there is a hierarchy of values, we're capable of perceiving them, and start reinstituting judgment. You know, when you do that, it's not okay, I know you know better, and you can never do that again if you want to be in relationship with me. Because I've got a future to create, and I'm serious about it, and nothing could be more important, nothing matters more to me, and you're either on mission or you're not. And if you want to spend another 10 or 20 years in therapy, fine, but the game is on, and I'm done getting ready to be ready. I'm done getting ready to be ready. I'm ready now. We don't have 20 years left. When I was a kid, I turned 13 on the first Earth Day, and I was so relieved and so elated. I went to see the original Broadway cast of Hair. It was April 20th, 1972, the first Earth Day. My birthday was the 21st. And there were pictures of One World everywhere in New York and a million people in the streets. And there were posters up about the world, the biosphere is coming apart and we're going to save the whales, and the Clean Water Act was signed, and the environmental Department of the Environment and the Endangered Species List and Save the Water and Clean Water and Clean Air. And I was totally relieved and I was like, we got it, we understood. They're going to take care of it. Well, they haven't. They haven't and we haven't. We've done nothing but complain as postmodern people. We feel intellectually superior because we recognize the problems. But we're all interested more in our own special issue, our own special issue, than we are in really coming together, putting aside our own special issue, and moving beyond postmodernism. And to move beyond postmodernism, we have to reintroduce hierarchy. A natural hierarchy, not based on domination and power, but based on competence. Based on competence. So plus one is experienced as a sexual impulse that's expressed as the creative impulse, but we know that you can be a creative genius and an alcoholic, a drug addict, a womanizer. There are people, the postmodern predicament is that we're addicted to consuming experiences, and all you have to do to give a postmodern person a higher state experience is get their attention off themselves for a trillionth of a second. And then they're going to have a mind-blowing experience of something bigger. The bar is so low, but we've learned painfully the last 100 years, have we not? That there's no relationship between an individual's ability to transmit emptiness and their moral development. Emptiness has nothing to do with moral development. Diane, I'll call you in a second. Emptiness has nothing to do with moral development. It's amoral development. It's waking up to the place nothing happens, that nothing has to be done in, and no choices have to be made in relationship to. But you're meditating, and there's a knock at the door, and then you have to respond. If you saw Hitler meditating, you'd say, the Führer looks very peaceful today. Look at that beautiful smile. It only matters what the person does when he gets off the pillow, practically speaking. Diane, yes?
Mom, I was thinking, you have children, don't you?
Indeed.
Yes, and I was thinking, there are a lot of children in this room that can't be seen, that come through a... And I wonder...
Oh, you mean in terms of people in this room being parents?
I have three children, and they have some children, and I would imagine there are others in here who have children.
Yes, okay.
The invisible children that are here, and I'm wondering, like, what do you... I'm not exactly sure what the question is, Lonnie, but it's something like, what do the children do differently? What are the practices? What do your children... What does zero mean to them in terms of their life practice?
Well, Diane, it's a great question, but I will suggest for the purpose of this talk, it's abstract, because they're not in the room, and I'm only concerned with the people right here, right now. And I would say that the second you change, they'll change. The children are going to be a complete expression of you. They're a total expression of you. We transmit our actual level of development to our patients, our friends, and our children every moment, regardless of the higher realities we may be awake to, regardless of the higher ethics we have, the higher states we've been privy to. What we're transmitting in real time to our children is our actual bottom line, our actual level of development, the actual state of our own souls. And the second we change, they will radically change in a way. Diane, as a mother, you could be in Guam and awaken to the next imminent level of your own emergence in a way that radically overthrew any constraint of culture that existed within you, and your children would be expressing it in real time, momentarily, because there is no separation. So I think the discussion of children and parenting, I mean, I've been discussing this with people investigating the cutting edge of parenting now for 10 years, and I think there's a lot we could talk about it, but it's just an abstraction here, and we'll just focus on us for a moment. So, yes, sir?
To follow on, are you saying that if I change, my children will change instantaneously? Or I watch their change?
It becomes less true, Arthur, after the age of 18 to 21, when their egos solidify. And so I'm answering the question to Diane more from the perspective, you know, frighteningly much past the time kids are 13 to 16. They stay 13 in the Jewish tradition, you're an adult and you're responsible for your own sins. Right? So prior to that moment, your karma is your parents' karma, but afterwards you're accepting, you're to accept bar mitzvah means you're stating to your culture that I accept responsibility for creating my own destiny and my sins are now my own. So I would see that as a truth for the whole human race, even if they're not Jewish, unfortunately. This is a completely elite teaching, but you're all invited. So I'm just making an ethnocentric joke to make people a little uncomfortable. Can you ask me at the end? Or is it right on what we're on now? Ask, go ahead.
I guess what I'm trying to figure out is we're saying that we need to be all moving toward this oneness and away from nationalism.
No, you can't move toward oneness. The reality is oneness.
All right. But what I want, because it seems like we're saying we shouldn't have the church anymore because that's God's problem. We shouldn't have...
Well, I didn't say that. Teilhard de Chardin was in the church, and he was one of the great realizers of this Dharma, and he was a Jesuit priest.
We're talking about nationalism, and that's bad, and we shouldn't have... I guess my question is...
Well, there are distortions in that form of consciousness at that level of development that need to be rectified. There was a time in history when nationalism was the leading edge of consciousness. In other words, the emergence of nationalism allowed people of different ethnicities to recognize each other as one, because we're all Americans. So you may be black, you may be Irish, you may be Chinese, you may be Japanese, Korean, Somalian, Jewish, whatever, but we're all Americans. So at some point, nationalism was a leading edge of culture, but it isn't anymore. So it's only a problem when people act like it is. But
how do we organize ourselves? I mean, there's obviously different ways to come to this enlightenment or oneness.
Well, there's only one way. It's there are 60 positions here, but it's the same step back to the center of the circle for all 60 positions.
Won't we just naturally move toward groups as they maybe follow what Master Lu teaches, maybe some people follow what Christianity teaches, different ways, so naturally we're organizing the groups?
Well, look, I think it's a great question, but I think it's complex. Christianity can move beyond its history, but Catholicism can't and still be Catholicism.
That's a great
distinction. What?
That's a great distinction.
Say that again.
That Christianity can move past the limitations of its own history, but Catholicism can't evolve and still be Catholicism. But your question is a great question. It's a deep question. And I only have 20 minutes to finish up here, and we could spend a long time in dialogue with each other over it, and I think the answer to your question would be a creative emergence. I don't think there's one answer to it. I think that's the answer. How can we, at all different levels of development, come together and recognize oneness? Part of the answer is that until you reach a certain level of development, you can't recognize oneness. But once you do recognize oneness, then you have to take responsibility for all the... Then you're on the hook for all the separation you're causing through your behavior and your dharma in life, and your karma, and resolving that. So let's move on here. So the next highest level of emergence of plus one... The first was sexuality, the next is creativity, the highest is the authentic self. The highest, the evolutionary impulse is spirit, and the highest manifestation of spirit is the authentic self, and the authentic self is the evolutionary impulse awoken to itself through the human heart and mind, recognizing itself as self. I am emptiness. Therefore, there's no problem. I am the evolutionary impulse. I am it. I am a vehicle for it. My incarnation, the highest point, the only meaningful point of my incarnation, is service to that impulse. And everything could be better, and I'm a vehicle for the realization of that. I'm responsible for the movement of God toward the realization of the true, the good, and the beautiful in incarnation. The traditional Eastern awakening is an awakening of transcendence of the world, the evolutionarily enlightened awakening to the evolutionary impulse as self, is the realization of the world, the universe, as God's body, and our consciousness as human beings as the leading edge of that emergence, as God awakens to him, her, or itself through us as the motive cause of the universe. That is the authentic self. And its position is, there's no time, there's no excuses, there's nothing in the way. There's nothing left to overcome. There's nothing to get over. As bad as anything you've ever suffered was, may have been, or was, or actually is, your life is mine. Now. And there's nothing in the way. You're the most fortunate people. We're the most fortunate people who've ever lived. More conscious now. More conscious now. And this evolution of consciousness is forever. And for its own sake. The Celestine prophecies, what the bleep? It's all nonsense. The evolution of consciousness is for the sake of the evolution of consciousness. The emergence of virtue in this world is for the sake of God and for the sake of virtue. And it doesn't mean you're going to have good sex, a pleasant partner, your business is going to do well, or that your body will remain healthy. There's no relationship whatsoever. And to posit a relationship is to bind oneself to that cycle through the vehicle of fear and desire. Fear conditions the water, desire conditions the heart. That's a psychological perspective on existence. The psychological perspective, pervasive in culture the last 100 years, is I exist out here. I'm wounded and suffering and traumatized. I'm a wounded inner child that needs to be loved. Let me tell you, that inner child is Gollum. It's never going to be healed, and why should it? Why should a 6-year-old who was raped be healed? Especially when it's getting so much attention. Why should it ever get over itself? That's what it is. That's what it is. So, we use acupuncture. If the person's a little too tense, give them some Xiaoyuan. If wood rises a little too much and they become a little manic, do Heart 7. If they crave sweets in this world, because they're a woman who thinks for some weird reason she should be sweet. Oh, you're a woman, you should eat sweet to become sweet. What? Maybe someone should tell Hillary that. Well, it's just when I look for a woman who's autonomous and has integrity and is pushing an edge in culture, I don't look for someone who's sweet. I look for someone who's making other people uncomfortable in all the right ways. But maybe that's just me. Like Alice Paul, who changed herself to the White House fence and won you all the right to vote by one vote. But I wouldn't look at Alice Paul and say, oh, she's so sweet. And if you follow that dietary device and become diabetic, it will not be my fault. So you just use acupuncture to keep moving people around the cycle. The cycle. You're afraid? Oh, let's do some wood points and move you up to creativity. Over creative? You get the idea that people would put themselves in a warm bath, hook up a nice morphine cognac drip, have some synthesized shakuhachi flute music on a $49 boombox, light their favorite kind of incense, and have people of their preferred sexual persuasion fanning them with palm fronds, and have a little bell so they could go, I feel something. Right here, could you scratch it? Hardly the kind of spiritual warriors we need here in the 21st century. We're all... The goal of spiritual endeavor and holistic medicine has been to make the most fortunate people who've ever lived become comfortable. So we've talked about zero, we've talked about plus one, we're going to talk about minus one. That's a bad attitude. Minus one is ego. What are the attributes of postmodern ego? Every patient I've ever had has the thesis that what happened to me, if it happened to you, you would have done better with it, but it affected me as strongly as it did because I'm very sensitive. The postmodern ego feels sensitive, wounded, needs to overcome some past trauma, needs time to be whole, is entertaining itself with endless spiritual endeavors while it's getting ready to be ready. It's not ready now. It's like the Super Bowl is going on and the player's still doing push-ups back at home. And you go, the game is on, don't you know it? They go, don't worry, I'll know when it's time. And they imagine that when they die, they're going to go toward the light, that when they're called on the field, they're going to be ready to play, but forget it, man. They're just getting ready to be ready. They don't know what ready is. That sounds judgmental. That sounds judgmental. So the postmodern ego is a part of ourselves that identifies with thought, feeling, and emotion, and needs more time to overcome all those things, and feels highly victimized by the thoughts, feelings, and emotions it's having. You are not your thoughts, and your thoughts don't create reality. Only your relationship to your thoughts create reality. I have thoughts all the time that I don't act on. So do you. You can tell the maturity of a human being by the degree to which the evolutionary maturity of a human being by the degree to which they renounce thought and know that thought is not self. How do you even know they're your thoughts? So postmodern people meditate and do qigong and do tai chi and take herbs always as a way of manipulating their experience out there in the circle. I want to have a more pleasant experience. And if I'm having an unpleasant experience, there's a problem. There's zero, infinite emptiness. Infinite emptiness, the unborn, beyond the mind. No words could ever convey it. Words can be a vehicle to awaken you to it, and it doesn't take any time, but words can't convey it. And out of that explodes spirit. Boom! The movement toward Eros, the movement toward the true, the good, the beautiful. The true, the good, and the beautiful. And at some moment in life, we have a wound, a trauma. We draw a conclusion about what that means. We draw a conclusion about who we are, how life is, how God is, and we attribute meaning, constitutionally conditioned meaning, according to the five-element model, to that occurrence, and the ego is born in a moment of trauma. Ego is born at a moment of trauma. You go to therapy and the therapist says, okay, and if it's Reikian therapy, you can go back to the womb, which in my case would have been the year prior to April 1958. And if you go to an astrologer or some other person who fancies themselves psychic, hell, you can go back to Atlantis, 50,000 years. But that therapy is always looking for the cause of self in time. And the cause of who we really are doesn't exist in time because it wasn't born and it doesn't die. It's birthless and it's deathless. So therapy says, let's go back and start reviewing and work our way this way. And of course, while you're working your way this way, this is going here. You're always working through the past. And you always see yourself as the cause of some past born in time, and whenever the ego gets to the root of itself, here, at the fundamental basis of ego, there's always a problem to be resolved. Never now, but at some future time. And the ego is that force of habit that convinces us over and over and again that who we are is out here in this wheel. So something happened, you ask the water type who they are, and they say, well, at any moment of life, a pillar of strength can be pulled out underneath you. And the proof of that is when I was 6, my father left. When I was 24, my wife divorced me. When I was 30, my graduate committee wouldn't graduate me, and now I'm 45 and I have this illness. And you ask the would constitutional type, who are you? And they say, well, life is unfair and God is unjust, because when I was 16, my father left, and when I was 27, my wife left me, and when I was 32, my graduate committee wouldn't graduate me. Now I'm 47, I have this illness. And you ask the fire type, and they say, life isn't safe. Intimacy isn't safe. I can't trust. And you say, how do you know? And because when I was 16, when I was 27, when I was 32, and when I was 42, and they're all just deriving different information, different conclusions that are constitutionally determined at the moment of conception, for I was caused out here in the will by this trauma, and there's a big effing problem. As opposed to, who are you? I'm an infinite, undying impulse arising out of emptiness, moving toward the future. And that who I am is not determined by my past, but is determined by my conviction in the future that I'm trying to create right here, right now. And nothing has to be overcome to do that. And yes, everything's perfect in the moment, in the sense that I realized at one moment in my life that whoever I was then, and all the life experience I had had on the continuum from most pleasurable to least pleasurable was perfect to get me to the point of recognizing that I am this and I am this, and that this is just a fiction. It's a fiction of an evolutionarily evolved nervous system and mechanism of mind that emerges from that nervous system that strings infinite unrelated moments of time to each other and creates the illusion of time and a continuous story of a self that exists in it. Whereas in fact, this entire life is just a vehicle for and a byproduct of an infinite emptiness and a great emergence arising out of it. So then the question is, if I recognize that, I then have to sit in face of all the structures and beliefs in myself that are in the way of that emergence. And I have to have a brutal self-assessment of the degree to which, even though I've pursued spirit my entire life, I have to really face myself and my own level of division. And what most of us are going to face when we awaken to this absolute dimension of self, zero and plus one, is that actually we're 99% identified with minus one, and the fears and desires of the ego and separate self. And when we awaken to spirit as one, and we recognize that spirit's demand is absolute, and ego's demand is absolute, and we are the vehicle for choosing which gets to enter the world, and that we're much more on the side of self-indulgence and petty self-interest. Is that my heart beating?
I can hear your heart. Yes.
That's freaky.
It's our heart. Music downstairs.
Oh, is it? Okay, I'm sitting there thinking, Jesus, I must be having a stroke, but I feel good. Okay, they're drumming downstairs. Oh, that was weird. No, but that is very weird. I'm like, oh my God, at least they were keeping good time, because I know I don't have tachycardia. Anyway.
I was gone.
Yeah, but I'm still here, so. It's a very persistent illusion. So reality is an illusion, but a persistent material reality. Yes, sir.
Would you agree that, I mean, the causes, the transformations from the tribes, create separateness. Even the evolving of societies, the new medicine, the new society, the new way of doing economics, all those things, somewhere from what I've heard you say, there's a change, and it has to be somewhat in the spirit, not just the structure. You actually have to confront the spirit.
Well, there are four quadrants of emergence. Any phenomenon has four quadrants of emergence. that we can identify. So we have the inner subjective, that's your experience of this talk, my experience, your thoughts, feelings, emotions, your ideas, your beliefs, that's all arising within you.
Is that Ken Wilber's talk?
Yeah. We have the intersubjective, which is the culture we share together. Then we have an external dimension. The external dimension, the upper right quadrant, is the physical form of things. So there's I, we, it, like the brain, and its, which in terms of the its would be the properties of the brain that we can measure, or its would be the laws in the culture. Mm-hmm. So there are four dimensions of things. And yes, what I'm trying to do is stimulate that cultural emergence through the evolution of a higher realization, through helping consciousness move beyond postmodernism. Listen, we study Taoism, we study Buddhism, we study Hinduism, Sufism, whatever it is. And my experience is that postmodernism, when I listen to people in our generation, or boomers, Gen X, Gen Y, talk about any of these perennial philosophies, the single largest input into their perspective is postmodernism, not Buddhism, Taoism, Hinduism, or Sufism. And what I'm talking about here is the limitation of postmodernism. You can do all the qigong you want, and if it's at a postmodern level of development, the body might get healthier, but your consciousness will not evolve. You may get calmer, but it's decorating the prison cell. You can take all the ayahuasca of all the tantric sex, do all the workshops you want, but if they're being taught by people with a postmodern value system, two people of a postmodern value system, and you're treating your patients with a postmodern value system beyond any of the Taoism or Buddhism or Hinduism that you profess to believe in, what you're communicating is a relativistic, amoral value system. You have your truth, I have my truth, nobody knows the truth, you'll awaken when you're ready to awaken, you're exactly where you need to be, you're perfect as you are. We're not perfect where we are. We could all be better. What does it mean? What would it mean to awaken to ourselves as this infinite and endless process of development, and to commit to that? The goal of postmodern culture was peace, right? Woodstock, peace. 500,000 people taking drugs and staring at the bushes. The goal was peace, peace. Peace isn't the goal. Peace can be a byproduct of evolution, but there is no place in this universe where peace exists. If anyone can point to me anywhere in the universe that peace exists, I'd like to know. A woman once rose her hand and said, my garden. It only depends how close you look. Get on your hands and knees and look really close. It's just weeds strangling plants and worms eating things and things eating worms and bugs eating each other. And it's just a fight for territory. And that cute little bunny who's out there is terrified and could be eaten any... I threw a ball for my beautiful Springer Spaniel the other day. And he ran for the ball and then darted right, grabbed something, shook it, went and got his ball and brought it back. And I went over and looked, and he had incidentally in 3 seconds killed a little cute bunny and then dropped it and on with the game of ball. There's no peace in the universe. The peace that the ancients woke up to was beyond the universe. In the universe, there's change, there's evolution, and it isn't going in a circle, it's going toward a goal. And we are the vehicle, at least in this corner of the universe, apparently, that can recognize the goal and act on it. Now, dolphins might be able to recognize it, I have no idea. Maybe they even recognize it more than we do, but they don't have hands and fingers, they're not destroying the biosphere, and they're not saving it either. So all I can do is awaken to what our own awakening, and all we can do is awaken and then take responsibility for it, and notice that we're vehicles meant to go somewhere, meant to do something. That we have a form meant to go somewhere and to do something. Do you see? Okay, are there any questions? We take them from.
I'm sort of left with the practical question of what I would say to my practitioner when I go on Tuesday for my appointment now. Like, when he's like, how are you now? I feel like, well, it's all like, take me around the wheel some more. Like, is there any point? Am I just like,
I don't know your practitioner, so if they have postmodern value.
Well, assuming that I have
But if you. I don't let my patients come in and complain to me. I mean, they come in, I say, what's the good news? Okay, what's the good news? I go, just for starters, next time you come in, what would be heaven for a practitioner? Wouldn't it be heaven if all your patients said, okay, last week when we left off, we were talking about this, and here are the three changes I made in my life based on that, and here are the consequences, and this is where I'm struggling, and this is what I've learned, and this is what I've seen, and I expect now that you know I've seen this, you are to hold me to it. That would be therapeutic heaven for me. Instead of working with people for a dozen or three dozen years and then having them stand up and cry about the same story we dealt with in 86. So you would have to just, I don't know why you're going. The vehicle can always use help. I mean, you know, our spleens can always work better. But maybe your motive for going would be completely different. And if you're going to a practitioner who can't help you evolve at the level of consciousness, then I would reassess the relationship. But you never know till you go in and express something different and higher. And then see, you should feel met, right? By any teacher or practitioner, you should feel met. If the way consciousness is, I mean, if you take a step toward the soul, it'll take 1,000 steps toward you. So as a practitioner, if someone will move an inch toward me, I'll walk 10,000 miles. Right? But you should feel met. But you never meet patients where they are. The goal for me would be for everyone to always be just feel a little stretched beyond their comfort zone. Then evolution's taking place. And what I look for in teachers is only relationships with people who make me uncomfortable. If anyone ever looked at me and said, you're perfect just as you are, I would wonder why I had wasted my money. Personally. So your values change. And the reason the ego maintains the status quo, see, the turtle goes into the ocean and meditates. And it decides to take off its shell so it can be free. And it takes off its shell and it says, oh my God, this is incredible. But it always leaves a finger on, just in case. And the change I'm talking about doesn't happen until you remove the finger for at least a trillionth of a second. But in removing the finger from the shell for a trillionth of a second, you're allowing for the possibility that the person who sat down to meditate will die there and someone else will get up. And they will have a higher value system. And if your values are higher, things that weren't at all important to you might become single-pointed passions. And things that you were very casual about might now occupy a lot of your awareness. And things you thought were very important might be revealed to be superficial and empty of any ultimate significance. And if that happens, then your values are going to change. And if your values change, your behavior will change. And if your behavior changes, your relationships will change. And that's terrifying to people. The ego doesn't want its relationships to change. The ego is that force that says, I know who I am, I know how life is, I will deny all incoming information that my conclusion is wrong, false, untrue, and frankly insane, and I will only let in that which confirms my own existence. That's what the ego is. Does anyone have another question? No other questions? Well, if you were enlightened, you'd have nothing but questions, because one of the attributes of enlightened consciousness is that it's always far more interested in what it doesn't know than in what it already knows. So people who are truly, to the degree a person truly has connection to enlightened consciousness, they're just like, oh, let's go, I can't wait to find out. Madam?
Well, coming from a humanistic psychology
perspective.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, it was 3 hours ago.
But just to say, not to interrupt, but just to say, that's where we're all coming from.
Well, I
because that's the culture we grew up in the last 100 years.
It's the only reality that I have known.
That makes sense.
And so, when you say that it's my compelling positivity that's going to melt the cynicism,
yes,
in my client's heart, I, until just you answered that question, I heard I would have to be in a judgmental place. But now I hear I need to be true to seeking the good, the true, and the beautiful in such a way to my own self without judging the wrongness. Or if Hitler comes into my treatment room, how is it being true to what I know, the spirit that comes through me, that will melt that cynicism? Because it can't be my judgment saying you're wrong.
I understand. Just to say, if it was 1938 and Hitler came in my treatment room, I'd have put a bullet in his head and slept very well that evening. I had some argument with myself about whether I should say this or not, but because it's simply true, I might as well be authentic with it.
Well, and Manson, no problem here.
So the thing is that we have to then make a distinction between what we mean by judgment. So there's discernment, there's judgment. We want to avoid prejudice. Prejudice means prejudging someone. So blacks are this way, women are that way, blondes are this way, right? We don't want to judge an individual accord and assume that they're just unconscious expressions of their culture. We want to judge them in relationship to their culture and understand to what degree are they unconscious expressions of it and to what degree are they disembedded from it and expressing something higher and deeper. So we take the individual on their own merits. We don't want to be judgmental in a way that denies anyone the inherent right toward a life of dignity free from fear. But to be a good parent, for instance, I have to judge what of a higher nature do my children know and when do they know it, and then hold them accountable for it. So if a 2-year-old throws a handful of peas on the floor, if a 14-month-old does that, that's one level of development. If a 2-year-old does it, it's another, right? Because at that time, they should start to know better, and they might be consciously doing it to be aggressive as opposed to just not even knowing their peas. But if a 6-year-old throws a handful of peas on the floor, or if my 13-year-old did, I'd have to be judgmental, and I'd have to say, you know better than that. I know you know better, and you know that I know you know better, and you're not allowed to express yourself that way, and don't you ever do it again. Don't you ever do it again. This love is totally conditional on your behavior and your performance. You have a responsibility, not just to me, but to your own realization, to human dignity, to everyone else, to live up to your realization, and you're responsible for that. This isn't just about how you feel in the moment, and when you act out of how you feel in the moment and selfishly express those emotions in a way that's uncontrolled, because you choose in the moment, you reserve the right in the moment to identify with your thoughts and feelings, even though I know that you know that you've seen you are not those thoughts and feelings. If you're going to reserve the right to act from ego, then here are the consequences, and I mean it. These are the consequences, here's your punishment, and I'm following through. So that takes a kind of judgment which acts for a care of the soul, because when the ego is judged and called for what it is and responded to as ego, which is the movement in denial of the true, the good, and the beautiful, with children, then the spirit and the soul can really shine. because they know exactly where they stand, and that's care for the soul. It's not care for the individual ego of the child. It's care for the soul, for the actual authentic spiritual dimension in their incarnation. Diane, last question. Then please don't run out. I just have a couple announcements to make. So I've traveled a long way, and you've sat here for a while, so let's just draw the whole thing to a good conclusion. But Diane?
I don't mean this in any facetious way, but does it matter?
All right.
Who wins the election?
Yeah, sure it matters. Of course it matters. I hate to get onto politics here, but I find it very cynical to say there's no difference. But look, one of the parties, and you can draw your own conclusions, has made it to a level of development that begins in 1860 and ends in 1945. And another of the parties represents a level of development that begins in the 1950s and ends around 1972. And it's a higher level of development. There are people in that party who represent a much higher level of development, but there's not a listening in that party for those values at this time. So I do think it makes a difference. And having said that, neither of the parties is anywhere near as a collective. One of the parties is never going to get there and can't, any more than the Roman Catholic Church could let women be priests, let priests marry, be okay with abortion. They could never do it. The Pope, the Catholic Pope, will never be able to say, the Dharma I'm teaching is my point of view, as related to me through my relationship to Jesus, and other Christians have other points of view which are equally valid, and Buddha had his point of view, and the Sufis have their point of view, and these are all just points of view on a truth that we're all striving for. And still be the Catholic Church, could never say it. One of the parties is never going to get to the point of transcending nationalism. It can't. If it transcends nationalism and reaches a state of postmodernism, it'll be the other party. The party of postmodernism is limited by this, you have your truth, I have my truth, everybody has their own truth, and feels compelled to listen to the other party's point of view, and can't even get up in a freaking presidential debate and say, my friend, you are full of... The worst word they can use is malarkey. They can't take a stand for anything, because after all, it's his truth. And the goal is peace, and we all have to get along. But the other party hasn't reached that level yet, but neither party is at the level of the Democratic Party aspires to world centrism, is only at a world-centric level of development cognitively, but not ethically, not at a soul level. There's still a world-centric, narcissistic level of self-centeredness. And they have it there. And the other party looks at that and sees materialism and godlessness. And they're not completely wrong. Whereas the other party, their version of spirituality is a pre-modern dominator hierarchy. So, yes, I think it matters, and neither one right now is capable really of the kind of answer we need. Neither one can serve right now as the vehicle, but only one of them could potentially. So here's the thing. Please let me end with this, and then I have a couple of public service announcements. My experience, I've been teaching in the field for 27 years. And my experience is that most people in the field don't believe in it. That the medicine is a complete intellectual abstraction to most people who practice holistic medicine. It's entertainment, it's philosophically interesting. But it is mind-blowing to me that people who will say you can take a 1/250,000th dilution of an energy form in a lactose pill, and that can create an energetic shift in the whole of the human being, and that can change culture. Or you can put a needle in liver 1, touch a point, And that small manipulation in a very small, not insignificant, but statistically small part of the self can create an emotion, can create a momentum that creates a global change within the physiology and consciousness of the individual. It's mind-blowing to me that people can hold that as an intellectual abstraction and yet express so much cynicism about the potential of awakening their own consciousness as the one consciousness in this universe. For all any of us know, the next degree of emergence of our own awakening will be the tipping point to a worldwide revolution and evolution of consciousness. And that's our responsibility.
Yes.
That's our responsibility. And the amount of cynicism and I'm doing Qigong, the moon, the stars, the sun. I'm taking homeopathy. I'm taking ayahuasca. I'm doing tantric workshops and having 15-minute orgasms. If you're just approaching it from a postmodern perspective, it's all just entertainment and self-indulgence. Where is the urgency toward revolution now, without excuse? And that revolution doesn't look like some big experience necessarily, beyond just saying, oh my God, I'm here, my life matters, this is the game is on, I'm totally responsible, I am the universe, I am the one intention in the universe that created it, I'm awakened to that, I'm in touch with the consciousness of God, there's no separation between the dimension of myself that recognizes God and God, I'm responsible for that realization right here and right now with no excuses, nothing in the way, nothing to work out, the party's on, let's go. And I just am amazed teaching people that they talk about all this as intellectual abstractions. They can translate classical Chinese. They can argue with me on the meaning of a stroke in a character, in the ninth character of the seventh paragraph of some ancient text. But when it comes to actually being living examples and taking the urgency, where is the urgency? Where is the passion? People do Qigong to relax. It's the end of the freaking time. Shouldn't be relaxed. Should be rooted in emptiness, okay? But where's the passion? Where's the passion? People see themselves as so impotent. You are the body of God, the one force of intelligence that's creating the universe. For me, the practice of medicine is a vehicle for awakening people to that. Every dimension of themselves that's denial of it and isn't that is illness. Every dimension of themselves that's awake to it and taking responsibility for it as health, and that's about as complicated as my diagnosis gets. And all the other elaborate theory that I know, I mean, I do a 40-minute pulse diagnosis on new patients, 40 minutes. You'll see, those of you who come to my seminar on Sunday, that I can do a fairly uncommon level of differentiation from very little time spent with a person. But it's all very simple. It really is all very simple. So having said that, thank you very much for the time you spent. I'll be here the next few days. Feel free to come up and introduce yourself. So please consider coming study with me. I've got a website called nourishingdestiny.com. The discussion groups are free. We're creating a culture there with values very far beyond the postmodern culture. I've got courses there with many of the leading thinkers and teachers in the world on medicine and Chinese medicine that you can do. Obviously, you can tell I'm passionate about this. Actually, I have no doubt about any of it. It's been my honor and privilege to be here. I hope to see you over the weekend. And thank you for your time and attention. Thank you very much.